The men of her cars dragged the carcass from the tent. The blood had gone everywhere. Even the sand-silk walls were spotted with red, and the rugs underfoot were black and wet. Braziers were lit. Miri Mazdour tossed a red powder onto the coals. It gave the smoke a spicy scent, a pleasant enough smell. Yet Heroa fled, sobbing, and Danny was filled with fear. But she had gone too far to turn back now. She sent her handmaids away.
"Go with them, Silver Lady,"
Miri Mazdour told her. "I will stay," Danny said. "The man took me under the stars and gave life to the child inside me. I will not leave him."
"You must. Once I begin to sing, no one must enter this tent. My song will wake powers old and dark. The dead will dance here this night. No living man must look on them."
Danny bowed her head, helpless. "No one will enter." She bent over the tub, over Drogo in his bath of blood, and kissed him lightly on the brow. "Bring him back to me," she whispered to Miri Mazdour before she fled. Outside, the sun was low on the horizon, the sky a bruised red. The Khalasar had made camp. Tents and sleeping mats were scattered as far as the eye could see. A hot wind blew. Shogo and Ego were digging a fire pit to burn the dead stallion. A crowd had gathered to stare at Danny with hard black eyes, their faces like masks of beaten copper. She saw Sir Jorah Mormont, wearing mail and leather now, sweat beading on his broad, balding forehead. He pushed his way through the Dothraki to Danny's side. When he saw the scarlet footprints her boots had left on the ground, the colour seemed to drain from his face.
"What have you done, you little fool?" he asked hoarsely.
"I had to save him."
"We could have fled," he said. "I would have seen you safe to Ashai, princess. There was no need."
"Am I truly your princess?" she asked him.
"You know you are. God save us both."
"Then help me now." Sir Jorah grimaced.
"Would that I knew how."
Miri Mazdour's voice rose to a high, ululating wail that sent a shiver down Danny's back. Some of the Dothraki began to mutter and back away. The tent was aglow with the light of braziers within. Through the blood-spattered sand silk, she glimpsed shadows moving. Miri Mazdour was dancing, and not alone. Danny saw naked fear on the faces of the Dothraki.
"This must not be," Kotho thundered.
She had not seen the Blood Rider return. Hago and Kohalo were with him. They had brought the hairless men, the eunuchs who healed with knife and needle and fire. "This will be," Danny replied.
"May she," Hago growled.
"And old Kohalo. Kohalo, who had bound his life to Drogo's on the day of his birth. Kohalo, who had always been kind to her." Kohalo spat full in her face.
"You will die, Meji," Kotho promised, "but the other must die first."
He drew his arrack and made for the tent.
"No," she shouted, "you mustn't."
She caught him by the shoulder, but Kotho shoved her aside. Danny fell to her knees, crossing her arms over her belly to protect the child within.
"Stop him," she commanded her cars. "Kill him."
Rakharo and Quaro stood beside the tent flap. Quaro took a step forward, reaching for the handle of his whip. But Kotho spun graceful as a dancer, the curved arrack rising. It caught Quaro low under the arm, the bright sharp steel biting up through leather and skin, through muscle and rib bone. Blood fountained as the young rider reeled backward, gasping. Kotho wrenched the blade free.
"Horse Lord," Sir Jorah Mormont called, "try me."
His long sword slid from its scabbard. Kotho whirled, cursing. The arrack moved so fast that Quarrow's blood flew from it in a fine spray like rain in a hot wind. The longsword caught it, a foot from Ser Jorah's face, and held it quivering for an instant, as Kotho howled in fury. The knight was clad in chainmail, with gauntlets and greaves of lobstered steel, and a heavy gorget around his throat. But he had not thought to don his helm. Kotho danced backward, Arrak whirling around his head in a shining blur, flickering out like lightning, as the knight came on in a rush. Ser Jorah parried as best he could, but the slashes came so fast that it seemed to Dany that Kotho had four Arraks and as many arms. She heard the crunch of a sword on mail, saw sparks fly as the long curved blade glanced off a gauntlet. Suddenly, it was Mormont stumbling backward, and Kotho leaping to the attack. The left side of the knight's face ran red with blood, and a cut to the hip opened a gash in his mail and left him limping. Kotho screamed taunts at him, calling him a craven, a milkman, a eunuch in an iron suit. "You die now," he promised, Arrak shivering through the red twilight. Inside Dany's womb, her son kicked wildly. The curved blade slipped past the straight one and bit deep into the knight's hip, where the mail gaped open. Mormont grunted, stumbled. Dany felt a sharp pain in her belly, a wetness on her thighs. Kotho shrieked triumph, but his Arrak had found bone, and for half a heartbeat it caught. It was enough. Ser Jorah brought his longsword down with all the strength left him, through flesh and muscle and bone, and Kotho's forearm dangled loose, flopping on a thin cord of skin and sinew. The knight's next cut was at the Dothraki's ear, so savage that Kotho's face seemed almost to explode. The Dothraki were shouting, Miramar's door wailing inside the tent like nothing human, Quarrow pleading for water as he died, Dany cried out for help, but no one heard. Rakaro was fighting Hago, Arrak dancing with Arrak, until Jogo's whip cracked loud as thunder, the lash coiling around Hago's throat. A yank, and the Blood Rider stumbled backward, losing his feet and his sword. Rakaro sprang forward, howling, swinging his Arrak down with both hands through the top of Hago's head. The point caught between his eyes, red and quivering. Someone threw a stone, and when Dany looked, her shoulder was torn and bloody. "No," she wept, "no, please stop it. It's too high, the price is too high." More stones came flying. She tried to crawl towards the tent, but Kahalo caught her. Fingers in her hair, he pulled her head back, and she felt the cold touch of his knife at her throat. "My baby!" she screamed, and perhaps the guards heard. For as quick as that, Kahalo was dead. Aegor's arrow took him under the arm to pierce his lungs and heart. When at last Daenerys found the strength to raise her head, she saw the crowd dispersing, the Dothraki stealing silently back to their tents and sleeping mats. Some were saddling horses and riding off. The sun had set. Fires burned throughout the Khalasar, great orange blazes that crackled with fury and spit embers at the sky. She tried to rise. An agony seized her and squeezed her like a giant's fist. The breath went out of her. It was all she could do to gasp. The sound of Miramar's Dur's voice was like a funeral dirge. Inside the tent, the shadows whirled. An arm went onto her waist, and then Ser Jorah was lifting her off her feet. His face was sticky with blood, and Dany saw that half his ear was gone. She convulsed in his arms as the pain took her again, and she heard the knight shouting for her handmaids to help him. "Are they also afraid?" She knew the answer. Another pain grasped her, and Dany bit back a scream. It felt as if her son had a knife in each hand, as if he were hacking at her,
to cut his way out. "Daria, curse you!" Sir Jorah roared. "Come here! Fetch the birthing women!"
"They will not come. They say she is accursed."
"They'll come, or I'll have their heads."
Doria wept. "They are gone, my lord."
"The Magi," someone else said. "Was that Aegir? Take her to the Magi."
"No," Danny wanted to say. "No, not that, you mustn't." But when she opened her mouth, a long wail of pain escaped, and the sweat broke over her skin.
What was wrong with them? Couldn't they see?
Inside the tent, the shapes were dancing, circling the brazier and the bloody bath, dark against the sand silk, and some did not look human. She glimpsed the shadow of a great wolf, and another like a man wreathed in flames.
"The lamb woman knows the secrets of the birthing bed," Ira said. "She said so. I heard her."
"Yes," Doria agreed. "I heard her too."
"No," she shouted.
Or perhaps she only thought it, for no whisper of sound escaped her lips. She was being carried. Her eyes opened to gaze up at a flat, dead sky, black and bleak and starless.
"Please, no."
The sound of Miramar's Dua's voice grew louder, until it filled the world.
"The shapes," she screamed. "The dancers!"
Sir Jorah carried her inside the tent. Arya. The scent of hot bread, drifting from the shops along the street of flour, was sweeter than any perfume Arya had ever smelled. She took a deep breath and stepped closer to the pigeon. It was a plump one, speckled brown, busily pecking at a crust that had fallen between two cobblestones. But when Arya's shadow touched it, it took to the air. Her stick sword whistled out and caught it 2 feet off the ground, and it went down in a flurry of brown feathers. She was on it in the blink of an eye, grabbing a wing as the pigeon flapped and fluttered. It pecked at her hand. She grabbed its neck and twisted it until she felt the bone snap. Compared with catching cats, pigeons were easy. A passing septon was looking at her askance.
"Here's the best place to find pigeon,"
Arya told him, as she brushed herself off and picked up her fallen stick sword.
"They come for the crumbs."
He hurried away. She tied the pigeon to her belt and started down the street. A man was pushing a load of tarts by on a two-wheeled cart. The smells sang of blueberries and lemons and apricots. Her stomach made a hollow, rumbly noise.
"Could I have one?" she heard herself say. "A lemon or any kind."
The pushcart man looked her up and down. Plainly, he did not like what he saw.
"Three coppers."
Arya tapped her wooden sword against the side of her boot.
"I'll trade you for a fat pigeon," she said.
"The others take your pigeon," the pushcart man said.
The tarts were still warm from the oven. The smells were making her mouth water, but she did not have three coppers, or one. She gave the pushcart man a look, remembering what Sirio had told her about seeing. He was short, with a little round belly, and when he moved, he seemed to favor his left leg a little. She was just thinking that if she snatched a tart and ran, he would never be able to catch her, when he said,
"You be keeping your filthy hands off. The gold cokes know how to deal with thieving little gutter rats. That they do."
Arya glanced warily behind her. Two of the city watch were standing at the mouth of an alley. Their cloaks hung almost to the ground. The heavy wool dyed a rich gold. Their mail and boots and gloves were black. One wore a long sword at his hip, the other an iron cudgel. With a last wistful glance at the tarts, Arya edged back from the cart and hurried off. The gold cloaks had not been paying her any special attention, but the sight of them tied her stomach in knots. Arya had been staying as far from the castle as she could get, yet even from a distance she could see the heads rotting atop the high red walls, flocks of crows squabbling noisily over each head, thick as flies. The talk in Flea Bottom was that the Gold Cloaks had thrown in with the Lannisters, their commander raised to a lord, with lands on the Trident and a seat on the King's Council. She had also heard other things, scary things, things that made no sense to her. Some said her father had murdered King Robert, and had been slain in turn by Lord Renly. Others insisted that Renly had killed a king in a drunken quarrel between brothers. Why else should he have fled in the night like a common thief? One story said the king had been killed by a boar while hunting. Another said he'd died eating a boar, stuffing himself so full that he'd ruptured at the table. No, the king had died at table, others said, but only because Varys the spider poisoned him. No, it had been the queen who poisoned him. No, he had died of a pox. No, he had choked on a fishbone. One thing all the stories agreed on. King Robert was dead. The bells in the seven towers of the great Sept of Baelor had tolled for a day and a night, the thunder of their grief rolling across the city in a bronze tide. They only rang the bells like that for the death of a king, a tanner's boy told Arya. All she wanted was to go home, but leaving King's Landing was not so easy as she had hoped. Talk of war was on every lip, and Gold Cloaks were as thick on the city wall as fleas on, well, on her, for one. She had been sleeping in Flea Bottom, on rooftops and in stables, wherever she could find a place to lie down, and it hadn't taken her long to learn that the district was well named. Every day since her escape from the Red Keep, Arya had visited each of the seven city gates in turn. The Dragon Gate, the Lion Gate, and the Old Gate were closed and barred. The Mud Gate and the Gate of the Guards were open, but only to those who wanted to enter the city. The guards let no one out. Those who were allowed to leave left by the King's Gate or the Iron Gate, but Lannister men-at-arms in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms man the guard posts there. Spying down from the roof of an inn by the King's Gate, Arya saw them searching wagons and carriages, forcing riders to open their saddlebags, and questioning everyone who tried to pass on foot. Sometimes she thought about swimming the river, but the Blackwater Rush was wide and deep, and everyone agreed that its currents were wicked and treacherous. She had no coin to pay a ferryman, or take passage on a ship. Her lord father had taught her never to steal, but it was growing harder to remember why. If she did not get out soon, she would have to take her chances with the Gold Cloaks. She hadn't gone hungry much since she learned to knock down birds with her stick sword, but she feared so much pigeon was making her sick. A couple she'd eaten raw before she found Flea Bottom. In the bottom there were pot shops along the alleys where huge tubs of stew had been simmering for years, and you could trade half your bird for a heel of yesterday's bread and a bowl of brown. And they'd even stick the other half in the fire and crisp it up for you, so long as you pluck the feathers yourself. Arya would have given anything for a cup of milk and a lemon cake, but the brown wasn't so bad. It usually had barley in it, and chunks of carrot and onion and turnip, and sometimes even apple, with a film of grease swimming on top. Mostly she tried not to think about the meat. Once she had gotten a piece of fish. The only thing was, the pot shops were never empty, and even as she bolted down her food, Arya could feel them watching. Some of them stared at her boots or her cloak, and she knew what they were thinking. With others, she could almost feel their eyes crawling under her leathers. She didn't know what they were thinking, and that scared her even more. A couple times she was followed out into the alleys and chased, but so far no one had been able to catch her. The silver bracelet she had hoped to sell had been stolen her first night out of the castle, along with her bundle of good clothes, snatched while she slept in a burnt-out house off Pig Alley. All they left her was the coke she had been huddled in, the leathers on her back, her wooden practice sword, and Needle. She'd been lying on top of Needle, or else it would have been gone too. It was worth more than all the rest together. Since then, Arya had taken to walking round with her cloak draped over her right arm to conceal the blade at her hip. The wooden sword she carried in her left hand, out where everybody could see it, to scare off robbers. But there were men in the pot shops who wouldn't have been scared off if she'd had a battle axe. It was enough to make her lose her taste for pigeon and stale bread. Often as not, she went to bed hungry, rather than risk the stairs. Once she was outside the city, she would find berries to pick, or orchards she might raid for apples and cherries. Arya remembered seeing some from the King's Road on the journey south, and she could dig for roots in the forest, even run down some rabbits. In the city, the only things to run down were rats and cats and scrawny dogs. The pot shops would give you a fistful of coppers for a litter of pups, she heard, but she didn't like to think about that. Down below the Street of Flour was a maze of twisting alleys and cross streets. Arya scrambled through the crowds, trying to put distance between her and the gold cloaks. She had learned to keep to the center of the street. Sometimes she had to dodge wagons and horses, but at least you could see them coming. If you walked near the buildings, people grabbed you. In some alleys, you couldn't help but brush against the walls. The buildings leaned in so close they almost met. A whooping gang of small children went running past, chasing a rolling hoop. Arya stared at them with resentment, remembering the times she'd played at hoops with Bran and John and their baby brother Rickon. She wondered how big Rickon had grown, and whether Bran was sad. She would have given anything if John had been here to call her little sister and muss her hair. Not that it needed mussing. She'd seen her reflection in puddles, and she didn't think hair got any more mussed than hers. She had tried talking to the children she saw on the street, hoping to make a friend who would give her a place to sleep. But she must have talked wrong or something. The little ones only looked at her with quick, wary eyes and ran away if she came too close. Their big brothers and sisters asked questions Arya couldn't answer, called her names, and tried to steal from her. Only yesterday, a scrawny, barefoot girl twice her age had knocked her down and tried to pull her boots off her feet. But Arya gave her a crack on the ear with her stick sword that sent her off sobbing and bleeding. A gull wheeled overhead as she made her way down the hill toward Flea Bottom. Arya glanced at it thoughtfully, but it was well beyond the reach of her stick. It made her think of the sea. Maybe that was the way out. Old Nan used to tell stories of boys who stowed away on trading galleys and sailed off into all kinds of adventures. Maybe Arya could do that too. She decided to visit the riverfront. It was on the way to the Mudgate anyway, and she hadn't checked that one today. The wharfs were utterly quiet when Arya got there. She spied another pair of gold cloaks walking side by side through the fish market, but they never so much as looked at her. Half the stalls were empty, and it seemed to her that there were fewer ships at dock than she remembered. Out on the black water, three of the king's war galleys moved in formation, gold-painted hulls splitting the water as their oars rose and fell. Arya watched them for a bit. They began to make her way along the river. When she saw the guardsmen on the third pier, in grey woolen cloaks trimmed with white satin, her heart almost stopped in her chest. The sight of Winterfell's colours brought tears to her eyes. Behind them, a sleek, three-banked trading galley rocked at her moorings. Arya could not read the name painted on the hull. The words were strange. Mirish, Bravassi, perhaps even High Valyrian.